Welcome to a special edition of Spectrum West. We've had the opportunity to talk to some fairly famous folks over the first 5 years of my tenure. I thought it would be fun to revisit a few of those conversations. We might do another version along the way, but today we're going to feature conversations with comedian Bill Engvall, Arlo Guthrie, Bob Carey, you'll know him when you hear him, Alison Arngrim, Jeff Daniels, Greg Brown, and let's kick it off with one of my all-time favorites on the show, because the man in the spotlight is one who hasn't changed. When I heard Peter Yarrell was coming to West Wisconsin, here was a guy I simply had to talk to. A hero of mine for lo these many years. From the time he and Paul and Mary made a sing-along to conscious-raising songs of the 60s, all the way through an aging process that's simply seen him get even more spirited in his beliefs and even more committed to making life better, in the collective, not selective, sense of the word. Back in September of 2012, Peter Yarrell and I shared a long conversation on the phone. I found him to be as open and honest as his songs led me to believe over the years. Here's just a bit of our chat.
The magic dragon lived by the sea
and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei.
Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff
and brought him.
I don't know what else to tell you about Peter Yarrell that you don't already know from 50 years of listening to his songs and lyrics. I do believe, however, I can help you out with a more intimate angle to who he is, thanks to the opportunity I recently had to talk with him on the phone from his New York office. By the way, in the background, that is Peter singing with his daughter, Bethany. We spent quite a while on the phone talking about life as we know it. He recalled his days as 33.333% of Peter, Paul, and Mary, the passing of Mary Travers, about the present in which he still performs, with Paul, officially Noel Paul Stuckey, and yes, he talked about the future. You like to think of it as a train ride.
Right. I think of it as this body of music and people sharing it who are on that train. The legacy of those behind have enriched the perspectives of those who are on the train. And when you get on, you share what you have to share. And then when your time is over, that music and that effect continues. It presupposes the idea of a certain kind of continuity. You're not alone. And Mary is with me whenever I sing. She's not gone. Her spirit, what she's said, what she's done, what she's stood up for, has profoundly influenced the people who have heard the music and who have come to the concerts or seen the programs on PBS. It's a very warm feeling. You know, it's nice that I came up with the analogy of the train ride long before I experienced Mary's passing, because one might say that I was trying to hang on in dubiously healthy ways, but I don't feel that way at all. That's the paradigm, and it works.
Have you written about Mary since her passing?
I've been doing that, actually, for the past few weeks, because we're putting out a book, and it's a book of photographs, but there is text. Here, I'll read you something that I wrote.
Yeah, please.
Mary was a single mother of 23, having grown up there was Greenwich Village. Recently separated from her writer husband, she was, quote, on duty, unquote, most of the day, caring for one-year-old Erica. So that's where we went each day, generally all day, to create arrangements for songs. None of us had any money. Noel was the least impoverished of the three of us because he performed and ran the entertainment at the Gaslight, one of the top coffee shops on McDougal Street. There's more here. Hang on.
Yeah, don't stop now.
All right. My memories of our earlier performance are best characterized by the starkness of black and white. Visually, when we sang together, it was totally Mary's show. She dominated the stage, her dramatic beauty as arresting as her remarkably lush voice. As she moved, the richly toned grays of the folds of Mary's costume, in quotes, as she called it, also revealed her intent as a singer, but differently from the way her beautifully modeled features did, and her culture-changing, in quotes, hair, always flowing, flipping, and floating with the music. Watching her when we sang was like watching diaphanous veils, one moment reveal, then another obscure, and the next declare Mary's passion and determination, her empathy, her joy, and her sorrow. These aspects of Mary moved differently against each other every time we sang.
Wow. Beautiful.
Thank you. I'm writing because we want this legacy piece to speak to what we experienced. Right now is a crucial time, and performing with this legacy in my heart and in my music and in my feelings about the people that I'm performing to, knowing that they're small audiences compared to what Peter, Paul, and Mary performed to. But to me, it's not about the number of people. It's about the quality of what's shared. And you never know who gets inspired and who gets interested and who becomes active and who becomes a force for trying to resolve some of the crucial dilemmas of our time.
You know, what's refreshing for me, Peter, is that you sound more involved than you ever have been.
I am. The beliefs that I hold are not a matter of convenience to protect aspects of my life that I consider to be, if not meaningless, certainly less meaningful than the same things that I believed in then. But right now, more and more, what the years have given me is a we perspective, rather than a me perspective, and a perspective of gratitude. I'm a very, very fortunate person. I love my work. I love my friends. I've been fortunate materially, and I've been fortunate to be involved in what people call giving back from the earliest years. And the rewards of that are obviously far greater than acquiring stuff or feeling good about myself because I own something. I work in a hospice where I sing, and you don't see people wearing jewelry and talking about the killing they made on the stock market or talking about their new car, their new home, or anything like that. All they want surrounding them is love, is to feel a sense of authenticity. And why do we have to wait to value those things as most important that we do when the chips are down and we really know what's important?
Sounds like a song to me. I think you ought to pen one.
Maybe I shall, my brother.
Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Comedian Bill Engvall came to Eau Claire to entertain in early spring 2012, and with his fairly successful stint on the just-completed season of Dancing with the Stars, some of what he talks about, like getting a gym membership, might have helped his dancing performance, and all the things he's done, like there's not a lot left for him to do. At the time, I don't think he considered dancing on TV. Let's eavesdrop a bit on what he had to say back then.
For my birthday this year, my wife gave me a gym membership, which is one of those gifts that you go, oh. You know, it's like giving a guy a certificate for hair plugs.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I guess you think I'm fat.
You're doing this because you want me to be around longer.
That was her excuse. How do you argue with that? I'm amazed that people still pay money to hear what I have to talk about. But this business has been so amazing and so good to me. You know, it's one of these businesses that, as you well know, it's easy to get caught up in what you're not doing. And then I talk to someone like you, and I'm sitting in my office, I'm looking around, and I've achieved everything I set out to do. I got to do TV, a sitcom. I had a gold and platinum comedy record. I've written books, been in movies, and now I've just sold a drama to TNT because I'd like to try my hand at dramatic acting.
Ooh.
You know, if the good Lord came to me today and said, Bill, you've had a good run, your career's over, I could walk away and say, I've had a great time. I mean, I've really got to do everything I wanted to do. And there's nothing better than, like, when you're on stage and you're on a roll with that audience. I wish everybody could have that feeling that, you know, everybody's laughing and you're having a great time. And I think probably the reason for my success is not because I'm the funniest guy out there, but I think it's because I do a clean show and I keep my material really related, you know, just everyday life stuff.
Yeah.
And I try to tell that to new comedians that, you know, you don't need to swear. And I'm not soapboxing here. Listen, I love a good dirty joke as much as the next guy. But I'm not going to take my wife to watch an hour and a half of it. And I don't want people to have to explain stuff to their kids on the way home. You know, it's because that's the one thing I've noticed is that, you know, I've had fans now that say, oh, man, I've been watching you since I was nine. And I'm like, A, I feel really old. But I got a fan for life there now.
You bet. I was reading your bio, and I was going back to that time when you were a DJ at a club, and you decided to get up on stage. I should ask Bill if he has been PG-13 from the beginning.
I guess that's been, I've been doing this 30 years. I think probably in the beginning, if I was to be honest, I probably was what I would call a club act.
Okay.
You know, there was a little swearing that probably didn't need to be there. But you know what? It was funny. For whatever reason in my career, the guys that shaped my career were Bob Newhart, Bill Cosby, guys like that. And I started looking at them, and I go, what's the common denominator there? And it was that they work clean, and they're still working. And I hope that someday when my career is done, I hope that people will look back on my career and say, you know, he was funny and he was clean. You know, listen, you look at somebody like Richard Pryor. He wasn't cussing just to be cussing. That was part of his lifestyle. But I just feel like I think an audience appreciates a joke better when it's clean. They know it takes time to write a clean, funny joke. I was doing a show in Bismarck, North Dakota this January, 15 below zero. I'd flown all day because no one flies direct into Bismarck. I get to the Hyatt. I walk up to the check-in counter, and the little girl at the check-in girl goes, well, hello, Mr. Engvall. Welcome to Bismarck. Is this business or pleasure? And I thought, what? Yeah, it's pleasure. What time's the pool bar open, honey?
And thank you for the joke. I can use that.
Yeah, that's right.
Nice guy. Bill Engvall, as heard on Spectrum West. October of 2010 saw Arlo Guthrie come to West Wisconsin, Woodstock, Alice's Restaurant, and so much more. Sad to say Arlo's wife Jackie passed away since we talked, but he's still on the road. His kids are also making music now. Here's some of the conversation we had between our studio and his hotel room somewhere out on the road in 2010. Born Coney Island, New York. I mean, how fitting is that? What a ride it's been.
You know what? It never leaves you. There's something about it. I don't know if it was the amusement parks or the sort of general craziness of living there, but it was a great place to grow up. I mean, nobody had any money. Everybody was broke, and everybody shared stuff, and everybody, you know, if you needed some food, you went to the grocery, and you didn't have any money, you just took it, you know, and you pay them later. I love that time, especially in New York, where you generally wouldn't think of people being so generous, but that's the way it was, and I think that's why my father loved it. Imagine a guy from the plains, you know, where there's nobody around, coming to a place like New York. He loved living right there in Coney Island, where the ocean was and where all the people were, immigrants for the most part, you know, Jews and Italians, and everybody's, you know, struggling. He just loved the place.
How much of a part do you think Coney Island played in developing who you became?
It wasn't so much that I felt at home there, but what a great place to grow up and some great lessons to learn. And you know, I still love it. I still carry it with me. I'd rather actually be out in the woods somewhere, you know, which is where I ended up.
It just seemed as if the way you were talking, the free-spiritedness and the generosity, that seems to describe the guy that Arlo Guthrie turned out to be.
You know, it was those things, but it was, you know, in a crowded place sometime, you can feel more alone than, you know, when you're actually alone.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It was that kind of mad rush of people coming and going and doing things, and all of the people coming to Coney Island just to visit, because in those days that was where you went to party. The Second World War had just ended, and so you had all of these sailors and you know, all kinds of other people being dropped off in New York, and they went to Coney Island. And to be in the middle of that actually gave you a lot of space to just be on your own.
Sure.
Because you could watch all this stuff, and you didn't have to actually get involved too much. So, yes, that has stayed with me.
Because of who you were and where you came from, was any of this expected? Did you have a plan, or were you just like the rest of us in the 60s, kind of living for today?
Well, my plan really was to become a forest ranger. I mean, I grew up, like I said, in Coney Island, and I thought, well, this is great, but it didn't feel quite home. And so when I finally got to be of age to go to high school, I started thinking about, you know, what are you going to do in life? And I decided I was going to be a forest ranger and sit on a mountain somewhere and play music when I got home. I'd never thought of playing music as a profession, so I went to college in Montana when I left high school. I lasted about a semester, and I came back and decided that, no, there was too much going on. The world was changing. People were out in the streets for all kinds of reasons. There was a civil rights thing going on, and the ban the bomb, end the war, you know, save the trees and the whales, burn the lingerie, whatever was going on. There was a whole lot happening, and I needed to be there. I mean, it hadn't reached Montana. I mean, it's just getting there now. So I left, and I came back and found myself, through odd sets of circumstances, playing in these little sort of coffee houses and stuff. And I thought to myself, well, okay, maybe you get to do this actually for a living and not just sitting around with friends. And I decided that that's what I was going to do, and I was about 18. I burned every bridge so that I couldn't go back, because my mom was telling me, she said, Arlo, you know, if you want to be a singer, that's fine, but you better have a real job that you can do, you know, something to fall back on. And I thought to myself, you know, if I take her advice, I will fall back on something. And so I didn't take her advice, and I made it impossible to do anything else. I just basically refused and ended up, you know, at times broke or whatever, but, you know, I just kept going. And so I find myself here today, some 40-something years later, still doing it, having made the right decision.
Mm-hmm. I've listened over the last few days to lots of your stuff that I hadn't heard, to be honest with you. Was it easier to write in the earlier days, the flippant stuff, the more fun stuff, or was it easier to write the more serious, meaningful stuff?
Well, you know, the truth is that I always believed that without a sense of humor, the serious stuff becomes so morose and so overbearing and threatening, mm-hmm, in some ways to the average sort of moments in your life. And we've seen them all the time. There are people always yelling, if you don't do this, the world will end. We're going to run out of oil in 2 weeks if we keep doing this, or whatever, you know. I mean, and there's people on all sides of the political spectrum, all sides of the social spectrum, that get so caught up in whatever it is they believe that they're not having any fun anymore. And so for me, humor was not just a genre. It was a necessity. So I couldn't do one without the other. I mean, you do have to take some things seriously sometimes, but not to the neglect of having a good time doing it.
I found it kind of ironic that you really came into your own the same year your famous dad passed away.
It was like one of those baton things. Somebody gives it to you, and they stop, and you continue. And I've always felt that way. There is a certain spirit and a certain, I think, awareness that he had, that he was able to hand off and say, hey, it's your turn.
Arlo Guthrie from 2010. In the larger scheme of things, the name Bob Carey might not be on your list of, quote, famous people, but to be reminded of what he's done, if you were around in August 2012 when we talked to him, you might reconsider. Maybe this is the best kind of famous, the lasting kind. You see, Bob Carey takes photos of himself wearing not much more than a pink tutu, posing in some of the most unexpected places, simply to cause awareness for breast cancer. It all began in 2003 in support of his wife, Linda, who was battling the disease. In 10 years, it's grown into the Carey Foundation, and he continues to take those memorable photos. Let's go back those 15 months to our phone conversation with Mr. Bob Carey. What's the question you get asked most about this effort? I didn't want to ask you what most everybody else asks you. That's one of the reasons that I came out with that. And I thought that maybe there was one big general reality, one big truth.
I can tell you something that isn't what I always talk about.
Cool.
The most important thing for me is to make women happy, or even people with cancer or any illness.
Mm-hmm.
That they're struggling through, for me, is to keep them comfortable during those times. And so that would involve different types of things that normally insurance won't cover. And, you know, I've seen Linda go through a lot in the past 9 years. And what's gotten her through these times is the programs that help women when they're having difficulties with their chemotherapy or their radiation. You know, they have different programs like acupuncture and therapeutic touch. And then They're the other most basic things, people needing rides to the cancer center. They don't have family in the area, or they don't have family at all, and it's tough. You know, a lot of things that are missed about caring for people with cancer, and I mean, usually most charities and fundraising, it's all about, you know, a cure or research. My goal is to make sure that women are comfortable and they have what they need.
You probably could envision the big picture when you undertook this, but there's a lot of smaller details that are probably turning out to be pretty satisfying for you.
Yes, and I think the thing that started it the most was when especially cancer patients saw the images, it made them happy, it made time pass. You know, it took them away in their mind, and they could see, they could imagine themselves in the images, something that they could wrap their head around and made them happy.
The things that you just described, are those some of the most surprising results? Because there have to be some very pleasant surprises along the way.
You know, when we started this, it was about publishing the book so we could donate the proceeds to a foundation, which is now our foundation, and then two other foundations. But it turned into something much bigger. And, you know, this was like kind of down the road thing. But once it went viral, I mean, we were flooded with emails with people's personal stories and how much they appreciate what we're doing. And it got really personal fast because you could hear it in their emails that what they're going through is what we've gone through. And, you know, my mother died of breast cancer 23 years ago, and my father died of lung cancer 4 years ago. My sister was diagnosed right when Linda was diagnosed. So we understand what they're talking about. And so now it's something that we never thought about when we were doing it, that this viral attention, mm-hmm. you know.
Now, Bob, since Spectrum West is a program about the arts and the humanities, let's talk about, just for a second, the artistic side of what it is you do. For many, you wearing a short pink stiff netting ballet skirt is enough, but as a photographer, you know composition is important. Tell us how you've chosen your locations for these very important shots.
Well, a lot of the times when I take a break, I go out and I'll drive usually towards water. My environment around there, normally it's just very spontaneous. And I will drive around in circles looking for places and never really planning a location or scouting it. I mean, I do scout it, but I look for symmetrical environments. I look for stark environments. I look for an image that has a center point, because most of my images, there's a center point, whether it's the edge of a roller coaster, or it's myself would be in the center, or a tree. And then I use the lines in the picture to bring it into the center, usually, but sometimes I'm on the side, but there's always a center point to bring the viewer from outside in. Never really, to me, inside out. It's always just like you're looking and it sucks you into the picture.
Well, you really are an artist, because I've looked at most of them portrayed on your website. And as you look at them, you say, you know what? That is the very best way that particular locale should have been shot. You are an artist. Now, we mentioned the Today Show and other bits of big exposure. You have obviously sat down with media people much more fashionable than I, and in front of audiences that covered, you know, entire nations. And yet your appearance here is really what your crusade is all about. I mean, it's about grassroots, and that's where a lot of the good things get done, don't they?
Yeah, we are, you know, all about helping the people that need the help the most, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we know there are a lot of great organizations out there helping to do other things, and we're there to fill in the blanks. That's what I think the most important thing is about what we're doing.
Do you have a favorite shot? I mean, one that you think portrays really everything about what it is, you're all in one shot, gets it all in there?
One image. There's one called Parking Lot. You know, to me, the making of that image was magical, you know, and when I do a photograph, it's the process is really important to me. And when I go out, I find the location, or I find something I think is interesting. But when I get into it, or when I get there and it's like not happening for me, one of the things I do is turn around 180 degrees from what I'm looking at. Because normally, a lot of times, the image is behind me. And I was in a parking garage inside, like a multi-level parking garage. And it was like I was in there 20 minutes looking for a photograph, an image. It wasn't there. And I was on the top floor of the garage. And all I had to do was turn around and look down. And now there it was. It was magic, you know. And to me, it's what we don't see is the best part. So we have to learn to turn around and see what's behind us. Not necessarily the past, but just, you know, just turn around and not look forward all the time.
Mm-hmm. It's that old, it's right under your nose syndrome.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It is. A lot of the time it is. The Tutu Project is just the first chapter of our nonprofit called the Carey Foundation. And I think I'm going to be doing the Tutu, those images a little bit longer. It's really important for me to keep photographing. And that's what I love to do. Since I was 17, I knew that I would be doing this for the rest of my life, or I was hoping I would.
It's important to us that you keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
It has an impact.
It means the world to me now. Thank you so much.
And give our best to Linda, will you?
I sure will.
Our chat in 2012 with Bob Carey. Some of the latest photos are some of the 10-year best. You can see them all at tutuproject.com. Chances are, if I said the name Alison Arngrim, you might say, she's not going to be on a Famous Folks edition of Spectrum West. I've never heard of her. But I'm going to wager you have. Back when the Ingalls family was carving out an existence on Little House in the Prairie and the 1970s, you might have tripped over the name Alison Arngrim. Actually, she may have done the tripping because she played the nasty Nellie Olson. Fast forward a few decades, and Alison is a comedian who uses Nellie Olson as a backdrop for a one-woman show. She brought that show, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, to our neighborhood back in April of 2011. I went out to my post office box this morning, found a card that is a promotional card for your appearance in Western Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And it has your photograph on the front. You know, the interesting thing is, in the bed of the script, it uses the word damn and it uses the word hell. But for some reason, we have to put an asterisk in where the word bitch is. And I'm thinking that's a double standard.
What is that about? Well, you know, and it's very different. It's very regional. It depends what theater I'm playing, what city I'm in. Obviously, New York, they so don't care. It says Confessions of a Prairie Bitch and
well, sure.
It's right out there. But it's interesting. Some people that can't deal with B-word. It's interesting because, you know, I was explaining this to the French the other day. in English, we have different conjugations of the word bitch, and it has a completely different meaning in different contexts. Obviously, if you're screaming at someone out a car window, a bitch, well, then it's highly obscene word. It's an insult. But in modern context, many people will say, oh, you silly little bitch.
Yes.
And it just isn't the same thing. It's sort of like bitch lowercase.
Well, that's also my dog's mother.
Right. Hi. It is also a legitimate term. Anybody who's dog breeding or watches those fabulous dog shows, you get to hear the word bitch on TV like 27 times in an hour. And there, see, there is a lowercase. And in the case of this, it really is. But I started hearing it flung at me very early on. I was at school the day after the very first episode aired of Little House. Calling myself a bitch wasn't my idea originally. I arrived at junior high the next day of first episode aired, and a girl up on the landing screamed, yeah, bitch!
Really.
And I had people referring to me as the Prairie Bitch very quickly, and I thought, oh, dear, now what do I do? So it's sort of a self-defense thing of like, all right, well, maybe this is my new title. I kind of like it.
Yeah. Well, Nellie, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Here are some adjectives I found other people applying to you. Mm-hmm. Wretched, scheming, selfish, lying, manipulative. What was it about that little one-horse town that made Nellie Olson so cantankerous?
And I think you left out narcissistic and evil.
Yes.
Well,
be honest with us, Nellie.
You're in this small town, and you know, there's a marvelous book HarperCollins even put out where they're doing these recent ones where they retell some of the Little House stories but from Nellie's point of view,
mm-hmm.
and they make a good point. Nellie's family from back east could have been born in a big city in New York,
mm-hmm.
but no, they had to move to Walnut Grove in the middle of freaking nowhere. Where exactly is one supposed to shop other than the Mercantile? Where does one go for shoes, the latest fashions? You have to order them from catalog, and they take months. And in Walnut Grove, everything's dirty in 5 minutes. It's dust, it's filth, it's horses. And who is she supposed to date? Farmers and the children of farmers. What has she got in common with these people, I ask you? And then the mother. If that was your mother.
Yes, I
constantly
know.
Harping and screaming 24 hours a day.
Would you not
find someone to take it out on eventually? People now watch and go, oh, good Lord, that poor child. Look at her mother. Oh, my God, no wonder she's miserable. And the French was the same thing. The first time I heard it was there. And they said, you know, Nellie was jealous of Laura's family, that she had a better family than Nellie, and that Nellie was miserable and jealous, and that's why she was so angry at Laura. So the French saw it as sort of a crime of passion.
Okay, now let's go to Allison.
Yes.
Where did Nellie come from in your wardrobe of acting tools?
I like how you put that, in my wardrobe of acting tools.
How did you manufacture such a nasty facade? Is there a little Nellie inside of you?
I think there is a little Nellie inside all of us. There were days where it's quite easy to do. Don't you have those days where it just seems like everyone is stupid? You're just being asked stupid questions over and over again. You're stuck in traffic. Things are just getting unnecessarily difficult. People are really making your lives hard for no reason. And you're just getting more and more exasperated. You just want to turn around and go, what?
That's right.
The Nellie starts to come out. And then in my case, as I've talked about in my book, things were not all they should have been in my childhood. I was abused as a child. I had all of this pain and really, you know, what you have is all this leftover anger when you're sitting on that. And I hadn't told anyone, I didn't tell anybody till I was 21. And so when you're sitting on that and you're not telling anyone, you know that you've been wronged and you feel as if no one you can turn to, there's a lot of anger there. That's what, you know, people who've been abused as children have, people who've been sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused. And here I was so lucky, I got this role where I had somewhere to put this stuff. I could scream, I could yell, I could throw things, I could break things. This was the most incredible emotional, artistic outlet anyone could have given me.
So Little House was therapy for you.
Absolutely. Okay. Saved my life.
Now back to Nellie.
Okay. All right, I'll try.
Shame on you for the time you and Willie made fun of Laura because her father couldn't pay his bills and didn't come into your store and smelled like a stable. Now, what was it about Half Pint that irritated you so much?
What about her wasn't irritating? And you know, if you don't have the money, don't shop at the mercantile. Really, just, you know it's going to cost you. People coming in all the time, they want credit. Hey, it's not our fault your wheat crop failed, okay? And, you know, she comes in and just expects everyone to love her immediately just because her sappy ma and pa think she's fabulous. Do you know she was trying to get everyone in the schoolyard to play that ridiculous Let's Visit Uncle John game? I mean, what is that? Have you ever heard of that? We were playing Ring Around the Rosie. You've heard of Ring Around the Rosie. Whoever heard of Uncle John is sick of bed? What weird freak farmer game is this? Yes, fine. Okay, I was Nellie Olson. Do people have any idea what I've had to put up with for my entire life because of this? What if I just, you know, said, yes, I am a crazy ex-child star. Do you have any idea what it's like to have to live with this? And just went with that. What if I told real stories from the set, from my insane life? What if, since I'm constantly asked questions about the show, about Michael Landon, about Nellie,
What
if I had a question and answer segment? What if I gave the audience index cards and pens and said, now's your chance, and actually read and answered all their questions on stage?
Mm-hmm.
What if I brought the wig? What if I said, I know you want to see me in the silly ringlets. What if I put it on and said, okay, here you go. Am I evil? Is it just the hair? And so I incorporated all these things in it, and I said, this will be a hell of an experiment. This will be completely crazy. I'm going to tell nothing but true stories. I'm going to directly address the Nellie thing. I'm going to have questions live. It was such a hit. People were so happy. They ate it up. They went absolutely mad. Standing ovation, tore the room apart. I had to do an encore.
Cool.
So I thought, oh, what the heck have I been doing all this time? Clearly, I had missed the boat. This is it.
And she is it. Allison Arngrim, a.k.a. Nellie Olson from Little House on the Prairie, as she was heard on Spectrum West in the spring of 2011. One thing I really enjoy about talking to famous people is discovering how talented many of the people really are. And I mean over and above the talent that's made them famous. Case in point, Jeff Daniels, a guy who's done some very memorable acting, his breakout performance in Woody Allen's Purple Rose of Cairo, after which he named his Purple Rose Theater Company in his home state of Michigan, his current Emmy-winning role in the HBO hit The Newsroom. Then flip the coin to another leading role in Dumb and Dumber, and more. He's also a writer. His Escanaba in the Moonlight continues to play all over America, and if that weren't enough, you find that he's also a very accomplished musician and songwriter. Well, back in the fall of 2012, the newsroom was probably just a glimmer in his eye, and he visited the Heidi Center. We talked while he drove his huge motorhome headed for Chippewa Falls. It's fun to discover well-known contemporary actors in bit parts on old TV shows like Jack Nicholson and Mayberry and John Saxon as an Indian chief on the Ponderosa. We will find Jeff Daniels on an episode of the original Hawaii Five-O series. Are there?
Yes, you will. Yeah.
Are there any other surprises waiting for us out there?
There were a couple of pilots and certainly about a dozen commercials that I did when I was starting out. You know, there's a Pepto-Bismol commercial that I did about a college student at the University of Mexico City who had diarrhea and was one of 250 students to use Pepto-Bismol. And as I tell my parents, boy, did it work.
Now that you say that, was that part of the audition for getting that bathroom scene so right in Dumb and Dumber?
It may have been.
Yeah.
For all I know, it may have been, yeah.
When one talks about or with Jeff Daniels, he, that being me, first tends to focus on acting, of course, but to our, and that being me, pleasant surprise, you're an accomplished musician and songwriter. I have thoroughly enjoyed discovering that aspect of Jeff Daniels. Which came first, love of acting or love of music?
Probably both, because I started out in choir in junior high school, and the choir teacher also did the musicals and needed guys to do that. And so when it came time for high school musicals, I was doing that. And so I was always around music. And I didn't get a guitar until I moved to New York City in 1976 when I was 21. I just bought one thinking that I'd probably have a lot of time waiting for the phone to ring to, you know, learn how to play it. So I did.
Did you plan on becoming a songwriter as well, or did you just think you wanted to play other people's tunes?
I played other people's tunes as I learned how to play the guitar. And I was a writer before I knew I was a writer. I was writing songs, god-awful bad songs, and sticking them into a notebook. You know, if someone had said to me in the 70s and the 80s, are you a songwriter? I'd have said, absolutely not. No way. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed kind of the creative act of trying to figure out how to make this story rhyme and work and what chords to put to it. So that was always of interest to me. And then later on, when I got the Purple Rose Theater Company, and then we needed to find new and interesting ways to raise money, we pushed me out on stage with my guitar and my songs and found that we could raise money with it. Now I just drive around the country, and I'll go every Christmas, New Year's week, I'll go to the Purple Rose and play those shows, but now I can kind of run around the country and play, too.
Sometimes when you dig back into the archives, though, those god-awful songs can turn out to be pretty popular.
With a rewrite, yeah, yeah. But there are many songs that will never leave the notebook, yeah. They're really bad.
Well, I think you ought to just put out a CD that is really bad music by Jeff Daniels.
Yeah, we need another one of those.
Hey, the range of your acting is Heavy Human Heartbreak to Go Ahead, Pull My Finger, and most things in between. How about your music? Same kind of range?
I've always liked range. I was brought up in the New York theater off Broadway, and no character was supposed to be alike. They were all different people, therefore different characters. So I've kind of approached the acting career that way, and certainly moving back to the Midwest to Michigan in 1986 and trying to sustain a movie career, I figured the best way to do that was to create a range, to go from A to Z. And that's why you see, you know, from Dumb and Dumber to Gettysburg, there are jobs in between those two. And I think the songwriting reflects that, too. I'm also a big fan of comedy and tragedy. The Greeks were holding up two masks. So I try to learn how to do both of those things as best I can.
I have three kids. My two boys are in their 20s, so they're out driving on a regular basis, so watch yourself. My daughter, who's now in college, she and Kathleen have an unusual relationship in that, well, I'm told it's very common, actually, that like they'll go shopping and then come back not speaking.
It's more about the connection with the audience. And from a writing standpoint, whether it's writing a play, a movie, or even a song, if there's no connection, then you don't have anything. I learned that out of the New York theater. How do you get that connection? And the way you do it is to write about you, write about the audience, write about the people sitting in the seats. And so that's what I try to do with the songs and with the plays I write. you know, I want people to relax. And so I want them to feel like I'm sitting on their couch in their living room entertaining them. And whatever they take away from it, great. Hopefully they've laughed harder than a long time, and give them a couple things to think about and then send them home.
I've got one request. Please don't ever go into politics.
Yeah, I don't think there's any chance of that. I was some Michigan politicos came to me and said, "Do you have any interest in running?" I said, "You got to understand what it would be like when I'm governor. I would bring, you know, the right in with the left, and I would just lock the door, and then I would start banging their heads together until they agreed." They kind of looked at me going, "So that's a no, right?" I said, "Yeah, I don't have patience for you guys. Well, here's how we're going to do it, and this is what we would do, and what do you mean we're going to negotiate? What do you mean you're a representative from some way-off district and you're holding up this entire legislation? Come in here a second. Let's shut the door. And by the time you leave, you know, you're going to agree." So I know that's not how it works, so I would be a failure.
Well, I'm hoping that nobody in Michigan hears this signal, because what you just said is going to sound pretty appealing to people. Yes, honest.
Christmas shopping for the well-known can be a bit of a difficult experience. A couple Decembers ago, I was in a mall. Everybody was watching me. Everybody. Even the mall Santa. Little kids were all looking right in my direction. Ended up going down to the bathroom with a mall. Went into the restroom there and got myself a stall. Sat down, proceeded to do my business in my private little sanctuary. And the restroom door opened and these footsteps came back around. Walked past my door over to the urinal. Whoever it was did his business while I did mine. And then he was done. And those footsteps started heading back to the restroom door. Then they stopped. And then they came over to my stall door. And then I saw at the bottom of my stall door a hand with a piece of paper and a pen. And a voice on the other side of the stall door said, "Excuse me, Mr. Daniels, I hope I'm not bothering you." "But would you be so kind as to sign an autograph for my wife, Loretta?" So I took the pen and the piece of paper. I looked down at the floor and I saw some black, shiny vinyl boots with some white fur on the top, red leggings. So I took the pen and the piece of paper and I wrote to Mrs. Claus, "Wish you were here." It a little something goes something like this. Yeah, it a little something goes something like this.
Jeff Daniels, as heard here on Spectrum West back in 2010. Nice to have you along on this famous Friday rendition of Spectrum West here on a Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, November 29th of 2013. I'm Al Ross. Spectrum West is heard live every week on the Ideas Network at 10 a.m. Thursdays, and back here on Friday nights at 7 on the News and Classical Music Network. Great to have you along. Finally, here's a name that in many circles gets one of two reactions. "Oh man, I love that guy." Or, "Greg who?" His name is Greg Brown. Years ago, a friend convinced me to listen to a CD and then attend a live solo show. Been a fan ever since. You've probably heard his basso profundo renditions of originals at some time or place and simply just didn't know the name. His music is deep and fun, sometimes simultaneously. I wondered what it would be like to actually have a conversation with the guy, Greg Brown. And back in the summer of 2011, I had the chance on the phone from his home in Iowa. I read that you had a taste of some of the Tinseltown stuff and beyond early in your career. How long did it take for you to realize that the I really was in Iowa?
God, that was so long ago. I don't remember. I was just back in the hippie days, and everybody was roaming around and on the road, it seemed like. But yeah, I went out to Vegas, and I lived in New York for a while, all that stuff, you know. I seen what was going on.
The first CD I owned was Dream Cafe.
Dream Cafe, yeah.
Good stuff. Single guy, like I was at the time, my anthem became Just By Myself.
Yeah.
Other CDs that passed my way were The Poet Game, Slant Six Mind I had, Covenant, The Evening Call, and now Freak Flag. So I think you can sort of tell that my visits weren't like those of a best friend, more like someone showing up at a class reunion every once in a while. Tell me where Greg Brown has gone since you really started recording regularly back in the 80s.
The way my career has worked is I started my own label. I avoided the music business as much as possible. I built up a nice audience around the country. I was able to record what I wanted, when I wanted to, with who I wanted to. And as I've gotten a little older now, I just cut down on the number of gigs each year. So it's been pretty good.
When I saw you play, it was just you and your guitar. And then it seemed as if some of the stuff you were producing after that was, you were surrounded by more musicians. Do you still appear as just Greg Brown and his guitar?
Well, a lot of times I go with my friend Bo Ramsey, who plays electric guitar and produces my albums. We do quite a few duo gigs. Occasionally I'll do a full band gig, and then, you know, maybe half my gigs are solo, so it's kind of a mix.
It must sort of relate to what the song is, because some songs were just written for Greg Brown playing his...
You know, not really necessarily.
Oh, really?
Songs can go a lot of different ways. I mean, I don't really have any set way they go. I'm more of an improvisatory kind of person. I mean, I change the keys and the tempos and according to who I'm playing with and according to that particular evening.
Well, you know, I have this feeling, and I think it's fact, that you and I are of the same generation. So I'm wondering if that generation, which I am proud of, gets credit for kind of making Greg Brown different and unique. And I wondered, what ingredients did the times swirling around young Greg Brown add to the soup that you are today and the soup I am today?
Well, I mean, I think where you're living and the times you're living in have a profound effect on you, and that does shape your view of things. As far as our generation goes, in some ways, I think the generation did raise up its voice and speak out against war, speak out against a lot of things. I think our generation pretty much folded its tents at a certain point, and the counterculture turned into the over-the-counterculture, and the level of activism and concern obviously went down.
How about your tent? Is that still up?
Well, yeah. You know, when the, I don't know how political you want to get here, but when the war in Iraq was commencing, I was singing out against it and speaking out against it. Almost nobody was. It seemed to me the country had been terrified into silence, and I thought that was wrong. And I spoke out and sang out against it, and, you know, eventually a lot of other people did. But I thought as a country we got pretty slow on the uptake.
I was able to download five songs from your new CD. And the song, I Don't Know Anybody in This Town, that is that kind of about what you were just talking about?
Well, you know, I think that song is about several things. It starts off in Highway 90 or Highway 9. It's all one road, just different signs. And that's about the kind of what's happened to our, I mean, there aren't any mom-and-pop restaurants anymore. There aren't any more mom-and-pop motels or bookstores or any other thing you want to name. It's a series of chains now.
Yeah.
One place looks just like another place, except it might have mountains or a forest or a cornfield. So the song kind of starts off in that place. And I think the kind of the lonesomeness, there's not a lot that's inviting when you pass, let's say, a bunch of modern condos. They don't say, hey, come on in and relax. Neither do box stores. To me, it's sort of a vacant-looking thing, and I think that's where the phrase, I don't know anybody, I don't know what's going on, you know, that feeling, that kind of displacement.
You have, obviously, we've touched on it already, the talent to write lyrics, lines from which people remember and they utter sometimes to make themselves sound smart, like, for instance, me. In an interview recently, I was talking to a retiring dance professor. I talked about Billy from the Hills in the line, I just jump around and grin. That was a good way of defining what dance can mean on one end of the spectrum, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and then from just by myself, lyrics like Love Never Made, A Fool Out of Me, I Always Was One, as you could see, I Can't Be Good, So I'll Be Free. Kind of like Bob Dylan, so don't get nervous that I'm comparing you and him. People are afraid because he keeps looking more and more like Vincent Price. The older he gets. So back to the lyrics. Are the lyrics the pride and joy factor of what you do? I mean, is that your hook, or does Greg Brown even care about
it? You know,
it's
the whole deal. One thing I really like about songwriting is you're working with rhythm and melody and the lyrics and the sound of the lyrics and the meaning of the lyrics. You can counter a point the way the lyrics are going against the tune. You can have a kind of a cheerful-sounding melody and dark lyrics, or the other way around. You can just, there's a lot of elements that you're working with. I really have always enjoyed that aspect of it. And also, you know, a lot of songs, a lot of great songs, you know, if you quote the lyrics, you're going to sound like an idiot, you know? I mean, but they're great songs. You know, sometimes the lyrics and the music go together very well. If you isolate either one, then you don't have as much, so... It's a lot of fun working with all those different elements.
Yeah, I'll bet. And, you know, the other thing that popped into my head as I was driving in listening to those five cuts, I was trying to get stuff out of them. Well, what did Greg mean by this? When you write something, do you want people to get out of the song what you intended for it, or don't you care? Can they get anything they want to out of it?
They can get anything they want to out of it. I think all songs are like that. You know, you can have a song that you love for a long time, and when you're young, you might hear it, and it means something to you. And when you get older, it might mean something else. Even on a different day, it can hit you a different way. So, yeah, songs, it's a meeting, you know. The song, the performer, the person listening to it, they meet. And whoever's listening to it is going to bring what they've got to it. I mean, two people obviously can hear the same song, and one of them is going to say, that is really a beautiful song. And the other person might say, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard in my life. And the song is just a song, you know. So people bring different needs, different levels of sophistication in the amount of music they've heard, all kinds of different things. Song's a meeting place.
Song's a meeting place. How cool is that? Greg Brown. Well, that does it for our famous Friday special edition. Here's hoping you had a nice Thanksgiving and that your trek through the holiday season is full of a good perspective on things, and that you find and encourage that discovery in others, a meaning of the holidays that transcends the Black Fridays and the credit card bills. Spectrum West returns next Thursday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network stations of Western Wisconsin, and we'll be back here next Friday evening as well. I'm Al Ross. Have a great weekend, everybody.